Tell the people what you're here for.
We got to stop it, brother. Let's get together and unify. Trouble.
Radio Basics.
And there's always a message involved.
Yo, what's up, Toronto? This is Radio Basics on the mic. Backroads Radio on the way out. We on the way in. We got a big show for y'all today. We're going to be talking about the federal elections, which I believe are probably wrapping up in the next hour and a half. We got a special interview coming up on that. We're also going to be talking with Shane Martinez from Justicia for Migrant Workers on the Supreme Court of Canada's recent decision to prevent farm workers in Ontario from forming unions, mostly Mexican and migrant workers. And we're also going to be talking with some mining activists from Latin America, Carlos Perez, who is up in Toronto for the Mining and Justice Conference happening this coming weekend. So apparently Osama bin Laden's dead, so they say. Let's talk a little bit about that later in the show. For the meantime, let's check out this boycott, this federal elections 2011. We have a special Louise Jones from boycott2011.ca. It's an interview we did just an hour ago. Check it out here on Radio Basics. Today, Canadians went to the polls to elect those who will take the reins of the Canadian state, or at least its legislative arm. The media and politicians have been incessantly urging people to come out to vote, a message which has seemed to take up just as much space as the actual issues of the election. And this in an era when electors are boycotting elections in greater and greater numbers each year, each election, either passively or actively. In the final week of Canada's 2011 federal election campaigns, the tempo and tone of the electoral circus has shifted dramatically. The NDP has surged in the polls throughout the country, especially in Quebec, leaving the Bloc Québécois and Liberals way behind them. Liberal campaign messaging has gone from concentrating its attacks on the Conservatives to attacking the NDP, with Conservatives also shifting their attacks away from the Liberals and towards Jack Layton and his party. On the other side of the polarization, supporters of both the Liberals and the Bloc Québécois are flocking to the NDP, as both the former parties are seeing their proportion of supporters decline by double-digit numbers. To be clear, in the interview that follows, Radio Basics is not about to jump on the bash the NDP bandwagon, and nor are we about to fall victim to the orange plague. That said, the question we want to explore with our next interview is the NDP really that different from the other parties? Our guest tonight, Louise Jones, was on the show with us 3 weeks ago. She is from the Boycott the Elections campaign, which was started by working class and revolutionary activists across the country. And they are calling on working people to boycott the whole electoral system, which they claim serves only the rich and not the majority of Canadians or working class people. Welcome back, Louise.
Hi, Steve. Thanks so much.
So your organization makes, let's start off by saying that your organization makes no secret of your communist orientation. So your opposition to the Liberals and the Conservatives is obvious. But people on the so-called left, and by that I mean to include the NDP and everything to the left of it, people on the left have very different ideas about how to approach the NDP. Support it critically, but vote the NDP, work from within it to change it, or completely reject it. Why is the campaign of boycott2011.ca calling on workers to reject completely the NDP, as well as all the other parliamentary parties?
Well, I mean, I think I'm already seeing so many workers and progressive people putting, you know, orange photos on their Facebook, and we can already see this just kind of blind support of the NDP among workers, and this is what we're trying to fight, because this is actually not a progressive party, and the left makes this mistake routinely by thinking that the NDP is a progressive party, a party that they, you know, that serves the needs of the poor, of the people, and the reality is we spend so much time canvassing for the NDP, you know, meeting with NDP delegates, fighting for small changes here and there, and we really get nowhere. And we can see already from the NDP platform, it's very tough on crime. It's funding 2,500 more cops. You know, it's just arguing for a little bit more money here and there, but the NDP on a provincial level has already cut corporate taxes in Manitoba and Saskatchewan. Mm-hmm. It's partnered with Lockheed Martin, which is the biggest military contractor. In Manitoba, the NDP government has been very pro-Israel. The Manitoba government calls it a special partnership between Manitoba and Israel. They're rewarding that state, even though it's massively atrociously assaulting human rights of Palestinian people. So this isn't very different from the very Zionist platform of Stephen Harper.
I understand also, just to you know, to turn to British Columbia, where the NDP government under Dosanjh, right, was it, deployed the largest military operation operation against Native people in Canada's history, which I believe was Gustafson Lake, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, it was. And this is where Aboriginal people were occupying land that they had never ceded in a territory, or sorry, in a treaty. They were occupying this territory, and they were shot at. The Dosanjh, who was the NDP government, was in contact with the police the whole time, so he was talking to them about their tactics, approving their tactics, and he has supported their actions.
Now, what do you make of this argument that, you know, the, even those who will acknowledge your points openly, the argument that, well, at the end of the day, the NDP is the lesser of evils, their program for Canadians is far less reactionary and capitalist than that of the Liberals or the Conservatives, and that we have no other option, we have no alternatives?
I really think that we have an alternative, and the alternative is to fight this entire system, to rise up, to go to the streets, to fight. You know, we can't expect the NDP to just give us national child care, to really roll back tuition. They're not going to do this. I mean, when the NDP does come into power, they move increasingly to the right, and we've seen that in BC, in Ontario. They come to power and they're faced, you know, they're a pro-capitalist party. They're not going to drastically restructure the economy, so they're faced with deficit. They're faced with pressures from, you know, the rich and the corporations. And they respond to those pressures, so they actually come to power and they impose wage freezes on the workers, as they've done in Ontario. They cut welfare, as they've done in BC. So we can't just, you know, blindly support the NDP, expect them to enact the reforms that we need. We have to actually fight on the streets for these reforms.
Mm-hmm. And I would also add to that that, you know, recently the NDP leader Jack Layton enthusiastically supported the bombing of Libya, so under the pretenses of a more humanitarian kind of approach. So we see how a more liberal orientation or a social democratic orientation really gets the job done. You know, they provided a liberal or more humanitarian pretext to the bombing that the Conservatives were taking the lead in leading up.
Yep, and the NDP government in Manitoba also enthusiastically supported the bombing of Gaza in 2009.
So how do you assess, how do you analyze this phenomenon where the NDP sits in the opposition for years, decades, most of the time doesn't get elected, but when it does, it suddenly, you know, given the reins of the state, completely shifts to the right, fulfills few of the promises, actually turns its back on working people, and actually aligns with the capitalists and you know, pushes through their program? How do we analyze this phenomenon?
Well, this is the reality of parliamentary politics in Canada. It was never set up as a system for the poor, for the Aboriginal people, for racialized immigrants. It was set up for the rich, and it was set up to maintain control of the rich and powerful. It was a colonial government. We are a colonial country. So, I mean, the system, we get to vote once every 4 years. At first, only men and only landowners could vote, and we haven't. The system that was set up in this way will never be a truly democratic system. We can't recall any of the people that we vote in power. You know, we can hold meetings with the NDP, but we don't have any money to offer them, so they're not really going to listen to us too much. They're really going to listen to the oil companies and the mining companies that can go to the table with them and say, unless you do this, we're going to take, you know, 50,000 jobs out of Canada.
And I would add financial capital, which is the most dominant strata of capital. I understand Jack Layton last week said that if he were to lead the government, that he would not touch the financial system or the banking system in Canada, that he would leave it completely untouched, which is the hugest possible concession you can make to the most dominating section of capitalism possible. So for all those people out there who have voted NDP or are going to vote NDP, I'm not sure what time the polls close, but what is the alternative then? You know, you're telling people that the party that's going to attack them the least, perhaps, or maybe you would argue otherwise, in any case, that is suggesting that it will be the most friendly to workers. If you're saying not to vote for the NDP, what is the alternative then for working people?
I think the alternative is not to go and vote and to support this system and pretend that we have a voice in the system. I think the alternative is to fight the system and look at how fights in Canada, in North America, were won. They were won through, you know, I see on Facebook everyone saying, it only takes 10 minutes, I've done my part, I've voted, you know, I walked down the street, and you can too walk down the street. And it's like, real radical change does not happen through walking down the street and checking off
minutes.
A box. It doesn't happen in 10 minutes. It happens, you know, over long, long fights, lobbying on one hand, but also just going to the streets and demonstrating, talking to people and getting enough numbers, showing enough support to, you know, a position of the government becomes unfeasible.
Mm-hmm. And indeed, you know, I know that in the last few months with the uprisings and rebellions in different parts of the Middle East, North Africa, the rhetoric, the spin that the imperialist media, the Western press has given to those events is that they're striving for what we have. Mm-hmm. As if all they want is to cast a ballot into a box. Whereas what we actually see is what really shook and even if only in a very small way changed some of those systems, you know, toppled one, you know, dictatorial figurehead, maybe just to be replaced with another one. Mm-hmm. But what shook those systems were people in the streets fighting. Mubarak, Ali Abdullah Saleh, they have not gone or they will not go with a ballot. They went with force on the streets. So I thank you actually for the campaign that you guys have led for the last month. We'll see what happens. In any case, I guess whoever's elected, vote or don't vote, we have to organize, I suppose.
Yeah, exactly. That's the whole point of this campaign.
And where can people find more information about the campaign?
The website is boycott2011.ca.
Okay, Louise Jones joining us on Radio Basics. Thank you very much, Louise.
Thank you, Steve.
Good night.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Radio Basics, we're back, and that was Louise Jones from the Boycott the Federal Elections campaign at boycott2011.ca, and we had her on the show to discuss the options that have actually been put forward for working class people and for Canadians in the current federal elections, for Indigenous peoples. Who are we voting for? Is the list of options that were given to us the only alternatives? Is electoral democracy in its current form, where democracy is limited by casting a ballot once every 4 years, and more or less outside of that, we have very little influence over the political system and certainly the economic system and social system in this country. Also today, we interviewed mining activist Carlos Perez from Ecuador on the show. He is in town for a mining conference happening this weekend at University of Toronto, Mining Injustice. Here's the interview that we did with him today on the show. Again, from May 6th to 8th, right here in Toronto. On the show with Radio Basics tonight is a special guest from Ecuador, Carlos Perez, who is in town for the Mining Injustice Conference happening this weekend from May 6th to 8th, right here in Toronto, and more information on that conference later in the show. Carlos Perez is a Quechua Indigenous activist and a lawyer specializing in community rights with a postgraduate degree in environmental studies. In the last few years, he has dedicated himself to the resistance against the introduction of mining companies in and around the Quimsacocha region of Ecuador, such as against the Canadian mining company IAM Gold. The region of Quimsacocha is a source of springs that irrigate a valley where thousands of campesinos practice animal husbandry. Carlos Perez is also the president of the Ecuadorian Azue Union of Community Water Systems. We are also joined on the line by Jennifer Moore, the Latin American Program Coordinator for Mining Watch Canada, and she will be translating for Carlos.
Buenas tardes a los So good afternoon. It's a pleasure to be here and to speaking to your audience here on the radio and to be able to share some of the experiences that we've been having in Ecuador as a result of mining expansion. Quimsacocha is a sacred place of our ancestors, of our grandmothers and grandfathers. It's where water, it's the headwaters for rivers that are very important to the communities living downstream in the rural areas, as well as for the city of Cuenca, which is a city of 400,000 people. So this is a struggle that doesn't just connect with the indigenous and peasant farmer communities that are affected, but all of those who rely on this water for domestic use, for cultural use, for livestock, for life in general. And as, for this reason, this area was declared a protected area. However, the government hasn't respected this and has granted the Toronto-based company IAM Gold 9,200 hectares in mineral concessions in this area.
Canada is a place where mining companies, Canadian mostly, are ravaging the ecological integrity of the lands, especially those belonging to indigenous peoples. Indeed, Canada is a world center for mining capital. So you've come to a good place to have your message heard, Carlos. What message are you hoping to share with Canadian activists and sympathizers of your struggle?
Bueno, allá se nos vende la idea.
So first of all, they have tried to sell us the idea in Ecuador that Canadian mining companies are very respectful, that they can carry out responsible mining even in national parks, if you like, and that there wouldn't be contamination, that they would use such top-of-the-line technology to do so. But we know that that's not true. We know that's not the case.
Queremos denunciar a la opinión.
What I'd really like to share, we'd like to denounce the behavior of these mining companies that really make Canadians look bad, that are dividing communities, that are creating conflictivity within communities, between family members, between fathers and sons, between neighbors, using small gifts, with infamous projects within our communities of small animal husbandry, or with donations of chickens and other fowl. They silence people effectively who were before complaining about these projects with these sorts of initiatives. They've gone as far as to charge social leaders who have been involved in these demonstrations. They've been buying out our media. They've been buying out our local authorities and financing projects in our universities in order to legitimize their investments.
Mm-hmm. So, Jennifer, as the Latin American Program Coordinator of Mining Watch Canada, what Carlos is describing here, is this out of character with Canadian mining companies' actions elsewhere in Latin America or throughout the world or in Canada, or is this much of the same?
Based on my experience and what we've looked at in various countries within Latin America, this is very much a pattern of behavior for our companies, that instead of respecting the decision of local communities or even letting them go through an informed process of making a decision about what sort of development they want to see on their land, these companies often look to buy the social license that they need to operate. And that happens in many ways, some of which Carlos has described, through these little projects, and sometimes through much bigger initiatives, such as carrying out studies through universities, which it's, you know, universities need to be involved in important decisions of public interest in their area. But the involvement of companies directly in these sorts of projects really compromises the work that they're doing and the way that their authority gets thrown around, particularly when local communities have no voice. And Canadian companies are operating in a scenario of impunity where they can get away with this because they both have the economic weight to to throw around mm-hmm. within the countries that they're operating, and there are no laws that we have to regulate them or to sanction their behavior when they're violating human rights abroad.
And if I may ask, Jennifer, do you find the actions of Canadian mining companies out of the world, do you believe this to be a peculiarity, an evil of this particular industry, or does this just reflect the logic of capitalism and imperialism, in fact, generally, as applied to this specific industry?
Yeah, I think this is, you can see this sort of behavior practice in other industrial sectors. I do think that mining and extractive industry is a very aggressive form of capitalist expansion that appropriates land and water and energy resources to an extent and a degree that's particularly voracious. Mm-hmm. And it's very input and resource heavy just to get a project off the ground, and so I think it's a particularly powerful example mm-hmm. of what capitalist expansion looks like, and that requires has also involved a level of political support from the Canadian government and Canadian embassies abroad that have mm-hmm. supported it, and as has the World Bank and other parts of this economic system that we all live in, to change laws, to bring about legal reforms, mm-hmm. to create favorable circumstances for these companies to obtain the land that they need and the resources they need to carry out their projects in a very cheap way, in a way that means that they can basically take most of the profits home at the end of the day. So, I think it's particularly illustrative of the capitalist system and of the sort of it has required a level of sort of neocolonial policies mm-hmm. and is an example of Canadian imperialism in the Americas that I think is repeatedly being advanced by communities throughout the continent.
Well, Jennifer Moore of the Latin American Program Coordinator, Mining Watch Canada, and Carlos Perez, a Quechua indigenous activist and lawyer of Ecuador, thank you so much for being on the line with us tonight. Us who are struggling here in Canada against corporations, against the destruction of land and the exploitation of labor, we're with you, Carlos. Nosotros estamos contigo. And thank you so much for being on the show.
Yo quiero agradecer y dar un abrazo fuerte al pueblo del Canadá, que el pueblo, entiendo, o más bien no entiendo, sino he visto muy receptivo, muy bueno. No obstante, son estas empresas mineras las que dejan muy mal predicamento allá, y por eso sería bueno que, por limpiar el honor de este pueblo valeroso del Canadá, puedan hacer presión para que retiren los fondos de pensiones de estas empresas y todo lo que vaya a contribuir por el hermanamiento de los pueblos. Gracias.
Muchas gracias.
So he just wants to say thanks and actually sends a big hug to the Canadian public that has been so receptive of his visit so far, but that unfortunately Canadian companies have been really giving Canadians a bad reputation abroad, and that this sort of solidarity helps to restore the honor of the Canadian people, and he asks that people would consider taking their funds out of their pension funds out of these companies mm-hmm. and as a step toward building a brotherhood and solidarity between our people.
Thank you. And as a working class Canadian citizen, I'll just say that reputation of Canadian companies as being terrible is much deserved abroad. Thank you so much, Carlos and Jennifer.
No problem.
That was Jennifer Moore and Carlos Perez. Jennifer Moore of Mining Watch Canada and Carlos Perez, an indigenous Quechua activist in Ecuador. He is in Toronto for the Mining Injustice Conference happening this weekend at University of Toronto. We'll have more information about that conference at the end of our show. For now, let's drop a track. Zaki Ibrahim, you choose. And when we come back from with our show, we'll be talking with Shay Martinez from Justicia for Migrant Workers, and he's going to be talking about the recent Supreme Court decision to prevent migrant workers in the agricultural sector from forming unions. That on Radio Basics when we come back.
When I thought that I could hold it in, whatever happened to the energy back in the day when the stars aligned, whatever we had to say, for the last drop dripping away, so now I'm wet from the talk and it's soaked in foreplay. Say, you wouldn't happen to know my forte, walking away is easy as a choice to make. The hardest lesson in the world, they say, is how you gotta stay paid on top of your game. I thought a whole lot about it today. I gotta stay brave, never ashamed, making a change. I never sway, stay true to my name. Make a choice with the words that I say, and my word remains in the music. Word remains in the music, the music, the music.
This is Chris Conley from the band Hot Panda. We have your son in our possession. If you ever want to see him again, you need to follow our instructions very carefully. Our demands don't involve money or have any political motivations. All we want is for you to listen to CHRY 105.5 FM when you're in North York. Probably shouldn't have left my name on this recording.
Oh, that's brilliant. Back to Radio Basics. This past Friday, April 29th, the Supreme Court of Canada has sided with the Ontario government in denying farm workers in Ontario the right to join unions and bargain collectively against their employers. The decision is the latest chapter in a decades-long struggle to provide labor rights and protections for Ontario's 80,000 domestic and migrant agricultural workers, most of whom are seasonal agricultural workers coming from the Caribbean and Central America, coming through the Seasonal Agricultural Workers Program. On the phone with us tonight is Shay Martinez, an organizer with Justicia for Migrant Workers and a recent graduate of law school. Justicia for Migrant Workers is a popular organization that has been advocating for the rights of and actively working with seasonal agricultural workers in Ontario. Shane, thanks for being on the line with us tonight.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
Thanks, brother. So for those listeners who know little or nothing about the Seasonal Agricultural Workers Program, a program that's hidden from the view of most working class Canadians, most people, let's start there. What is it? Where did it come from?
Okay. The Seasonal Agricultural Workers Program was started in 1966, and it was actually the latest manifestation of a much larger history. The Canadian government first started using migrant labor to fill the void in the farming industry by using European labor after World War II, mainly Polish immigrants. After that, they started relying on labor from students. They even emptied out a lot of prisons to use prisoners to work in the fields, and they even sought labor from reserves. They were looking for Aboriginal people to do the work. Following that, they started to rely on the Caribbean in Jamaica in 1966, and then the program expanded to Mexico later on. So today, currently, there's thousands of seasonal agricultural workers working here in Canada for 8 months out of every year, and they earn minimum wage, and they work under some really precarious conditions here.
Mm-hmm. Can you describe some of the difficulties seasonal agricultural workers face on the workplace? You know, I understand that through the history of the attempts by the Canadian state to recruit agricultural worker, as you mentioned, initially with Europeans, other domestics and nationals, such as those are prisoners, indigenous peoples. Part of the difficulty was that the inability to retain the labor. The work was so grueling and it was so low paid that people would just leave. They would just pick up and leave. And because in a capitalist society, people can, for the most part, leave from one job to another. For a lot of people, that means unemployment, or, you know, so that option is not as free. But for agricultural workers in particular, they don't really have that right. So can you describe to us some of the difficulties they face in the workplace? Why do they need a union, and why was it denied to them?
That's right. There is a real form of modern indentured labor here in Canada with seasonal agricultural workers. Workers aren't able to switch employers here. They come here under a contract with one employer, and they have to stay with that employer for the duration of the 8 months that they're working in Canada. There's a lot of issues as well with systemic racism on both the part of the state and on the part of many employers. There's immigration restrictions which disallow the workers to ever apply for permanent residency here in Canada, even if they work up to, 25 years or more here in Canada for 8 months out of every year. They can never apply for permanent residency here in the country. They're also always subject to the threat of repatriation back to their home countries. If they try and file a human rights complaint or raise health and safety issues, the employers can send them home within 24 to 48 hours, which is a power which even exceeds that which the state has in typical immigration cases. So they do face a lot of dangers in addition to pesticides and chemicals on the farms, and farming also being generally recognized as one of the three most dangerous professions by the International Labor Organization.
Mm-hmm. So, in essence, these workers were denied the right to unionize. It's really what it comes down to. What was the legal justification given by the Supreme Court of Canada? I understand at a vote of 8-1 in favor of the Ontario government. What was the legal justification given by the Supreme Court in the case of this?
Okay. The justification, more or less, the decision comes down to this, is that the Supreme Court of Canada said that the Agricultural Employees Protection Act, which is the act that's in effect here in Ontario, which denies workers the right to unionize, the court said that this kind of exclusionary law against farm workers is constitutional, that workers can have associations amongst themselves, but that there's no positive obligation on employers to negotiate with those workers. So it's really a toothless kind of protection. It's more window dressing than anything else. And unfortunately, the decision seems to neglect a lot of issues that were raised by Justice for Migrant Workers, which was our group was an intervener in the case, which meant that we had standing and we had a voice. We were able to express our concerns during the case before the Supreme Court. Unfortunately, the decision of the Supreme Court does not contain any strong analysis of the issues that were raised about systemic racism, immigration restrictions, and self-determination issues, which are really important to migrant workers. So, in essence, it says that although workers have a right to associate, employers don't have an obligation to negotiate with those workers, and therefore the law that was put into place by the province called the Agriculture Employees Protection Act is constitutional, and workers are still disenfranchised right now, and they're still disempowered in terms of a comparison between them and Canadian workers who do enjoy a stronger right to collective bargaining.
Yeah, I read the decision, and it seemed to be upholding the spirit of the Constitution by saying that the right to association still exists amongst these workers. However, my understanding is with the Seasonal Agricultural Workers Program, these desperate workers who are, I mean, desperate by virtue of Mexico's place in the International Division of Labor due to free trade, NAFTA, you know, American and Canadian imperialism, these workers are very dependent on this program. They seek to come back year by year, but if they're not doing what they're told, if they, you know, try to struggle, they may not be accepted in the following year. So really this right to association without the right to form a union seems to be not really worth much. What would you say?
Exactly. And I mean, although the law itself treats farm workers the same in general, like there's not a definite distinction between a migrant farm worker and a Canadian farm worker, there is a historical analysis, a historical context, which is imperative for consideration to properly understand what we're dealing with here. And as I mentioned, that was absent in the Supreme Court of Canada's decision. It didn't take into consideration properly, in the opinion of many people, the historical racism which plagues migrant communities and the difficulties that they face.
Mm-hmm. Now, I understand the Seasonal Agricultural Workers Program is not an anomaly in the Canadian labor force, that we have many temporary foreign worker programs, you know, where industry is recruiting labor directly into its own labor force, where workers end up becoming tied to a single employer. When they're no longer needed, they're sent home. The big other example being the Living Caregivers Program, where the vast proportion of whom are women coming into that program are from the Philippines, and you have Filipino women raising the children of Canada's richest, while working class women don't have access to affordable daycare. So how do you place the Seasonal Agricultural Workers Program within this broader trend in the Canadian economy?
I think we can place it in there by looking at how migrant workers are denied systematically a lot of protections that Canadian workers enjoy. Migrant workers, because of the way that the state sets up the immigration system that applies to them, they're subject to a lot more dangers than we're not. And that does apply to both farm workers and nannies as well, and living caregivers. Migrant workers, by and large, are far more manageable for the state. The state wields a lot more control over them. They're much more precarious in their status. The state can control them. They can frighten them. They can intimidate them. Or at least they can try to do those things, and unfortunately, oftentimes, they are successful, even though workers are actively organizing to resist. Mm-hmm. So migrant workers do form a community that the state does enjoy a disproportionate amount of power over, comparatively to the amount of power and intimidation that the state can exercise against Canadian workers.
So where do the struggles of these workers go from here, the seasonal agricultural workers?
From here, I think that we're going to see seasonal agricultural workers begin organizing in new ways. And so what I mean by that is that they're going to start to exit the traditional labor model that we've seen through collective bargaining and through unions. And I think things are going to start to become a lot more militant. Workers are, you know, these workers are very intelligent. They come from a lot of very deep experiences in their home countries. They're very politically aware and conscious, even though they are in a precarious situation here. So I think what we're going to see is we're going to see workers really standing up a lot more, being a lot more vocal, and developing a lot of new and innovative ways to resist and take back control in the farms and the greenhouses across the province and demand justice and control in their workplaces.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell our listeners somewhere where they can go to find out more information about this program?
Definitely. Folks, you can Google Justice for Migrant Workers online, and we've got a lot of information on our website that folks can check out. We have a lot of written resources. We have links on YouTube as well. And from time to time, we have audio resources as well. So there's all kinds of information online, and hopefully you folks, any listeners out there, can go on, check out the information that we have available, learn more about the situation, because it is a population, migrant agricultural mm-hmm. workers here in Ontario, it's a population that the Canadian government really tries to hide, mm-hmm. because mm-hmm. Once you start learning what the real situation is that's going on down here in southern Ontario, it is really mind-blowing.
Mm-hmm.
And it's something that people need to learn about and reach out in solidarity with migrant workers, take their lead and ask them what they need, and offer up that support so they can continue their struggle.
All right. Shea Martinez, thanks for being on the line with us.
Thanks a lot, Steve.
All right. Good night.
Ciao.
That was Shea Martinez of Justice for Migrant Workers. You can check out more information about the program and what's happening to agricultural workers in Canada by just, you know, check out the website that he listed or Google Justice for Migrant Workers. So apparently Osama bin Laden has been killed in a supposedly unauthorized raid by the CIA and U.S. Special Forces in Pakistan, which apparently Pakistan knew nothing about. Osama's body was tested for DNA verification and then dumped in the ocean or the sea. I'm not really sure. But there's so much that seems absurd about the story that I don't even know where to begin unpacking it. But two short things to start. If the CIA had the whereabouts of what we have been led to believe is the most wanted man of the new millennium, a man who we are led to believe justifies a global war, an endless war on terror, wouldn't you want to put this man on trial and discredit his cause thoroughly, put him in front of the world, let him be judged? And even if we were to believe that he was killed in battle, why would the remains of his body be disposed of in the sea, for no one ever more to be able to track down or independently verify? Let these questions stir, and the many more that will be provoked if you begin scratching behind the surface of the story, while I drop this next track from Mos Def and Immortal Technique. Some of you may recognize it. Check it out. This is Bin Laden.
Man, you hear this bullshit they be talking? Every day, man, it's like these motherfuckers just like professional liars, you know what I'm saying? Swow. Listen, Bin Laden didn't blow up the projects. It was you and her head. Tell the truth, nigga.
Bush knocked down the towers.
Tell the truth, nigga.
Bush knocked down the towers.
Tell the truth, nigga. Bin Laden didn't blow up the projects. It was you and her head. Tell the truth, nigga.
Bush knocked down the towers.
Tell the truth, nigga.
Bush knocked down the towers.
I pledge no allegiance. We're gonna smoke the president's speeches. I'm baptized by America and covered in leeches. The dirty water that bleaches your soul and your facial features, drowning you in propaganda that they spit through the speakers. And if you speak about the evil that the government does, the Patriot Act to track you to the type of your blood. They try to frame you and say you was trying to sell drugs and throw a federal indictment on to him to show you love. This shit is run by fake Christians, fake politicians. Look at their mansions and look at the conditions you live in. All they talk about is terrorism on television. They tell you to listen, but they don't really tell you their mission. They funded Al-Qaeda and now they blame the Muslim religion. Even though Bin Laden was a CIA tactician, they gave him billions of dollars and they funded his purpose. Fahrenheit 9/11, that's just scratching the surface.
Bin Laden didn't blow up the projects. It was your niggas. Tell the truth, niggas.
Bush knocked down the towers.
Tell the truth, niggas.
Bush knocked down the towers.
Like, Bin Laden didn't blow up the projects. It was your niggas. Tell the truth, niggas.
Bush knocked down the towers.
Tell the truth, niggas.
Bush knocked down the towers.
They say the rebels in the racks
still fight for Saddam, but that's bullish. I'll show you why it's totally wrong. Cause if another country invaded the hood tonight, it'd be warfare through Harlem and Washington Heights. I wouldn't be fighting for Bush or white America's dream. I'd be fighting for my people's survival and self-esteem. I wouldn't fight for racist churches from the south, my nigga. I'd be fighting to keep the occupation out, my nigga. You ever clock someone who talk ish or look at you wrong? Imagine if they shot at you and was raping your moms. And of course Saddam Hussein had chemical weapons. We sold them that ish after Ronald Reagan's election. Mercenary contractors fighting a new era. Corporate military banking off the war on terror. They controlling the ghetto with the fear of attack. Trying to distract the fact that they engineering the crack. So I'm strapped like Lee Malvo holding a sniper rifle. These bullets will touch your kids. And I don't mean like Michael. Your body be sent to the morgue, stripped down and recycled. I fire on houses that support you and like you. Cause innocent people get murdered in the struggle daily. And poor people never get ish and struggle daily. This ain't no alien conspiracy theory. This ish is real. Written on a dollar underneath the Masonic seal.
Immortal Tech featuring Mos Def. That was Bin Laden. The late Bin Laden, the early Bin Laden, the dead Bin Laden. Who really knows? Who really knows? All we got to know, all we got to remember is that Bin Laden and the entirety of the Al-Qaeda, whatever Al-Qaeda is, which is a really nebulous thing that you can't really specify in any terms, was for some period of time and probably still is to a certain extent from what we know about the war on terror and how many terrorists have been entrapped and set up by CIA infiltrators, that more or less much of this force has been intelligence assets. And we really can't draw the line. We really don't know where to draw the line between where these terrorists are intelligence assets and whether they're, you know, how to the extent to which they're actually infiltrated by imperialism and helping them fulfill its cause. So ask these questions, man. Is Bin Laden really dead? Is he alive? Who really cares? All we know is that the war on terror is inflicting great pain on the peoples of the world. We had a commentator on the line who called in, who wanted to say a few words about the Seasonal Agricultural Workers Program. Are you on the line with us, brother?
Yes, I am. My name is Omar. I'm also a law grad. What I wanted to add real quickly is that the APA, the act that Shane was discussing, was enacted by the Harris regime. There was very briefly a point in time when agricultural workers could have the right to create unions, but that entire scheme was rolled back. Uh-huh. So if you do care about agricultural workers, you care about the right to unionize, what you need to do is get out there and get to the polls and make a difference at the polls. We have half an hour to do that. I do want all your listeners to get out there and make your vote count. If I can add real briefly as well, I did publish a paper. It's called A Trial to End All Terrorism. It speaks exactly to the issue of what you're speaking about. Terrorism is not going to end until you have someone like Bin Laden on trial or someone else, because a military solution is not going to be a solution at all. So thanks again for your good work, and I really enjoy your show.
Okay, Omar, thanks for the comments. All right, that was a commentator calling in, Omar, who says that you should go out to the polls. You know, we're exploring this precise issue on the radio show today, the extent to which change can or cannot be made through the polls. You know, I understand that the NDP, when they were in power in Ontario in the early 1990s, they passed a law that allowed agricultural workers to organize themselves, but they did it when they were on their way out, and presumably, one can maybe argue that everybody very well knew that the law was going to be overturned by Harris when he came back in. So, you know, we discussed earlier in the show with Louise Jones from the boycott campaign, this toing and froing back and forth between, you know, liberals and conservatives being in power, the NDP being a constant voice of criticism and opposition, which appeals to a lot of working class people. And the NDP then comes to power. And as we discussed earlier in the show, Manitoba, Saskatchewan, Ontario, everywhere else where they've been in power, they completely betray the working class. They don't really fulfill their promises, or to a far lesser extent than they said they would. And in many cases, they actually serve the interests of capital. Meanwhile, you know, people don't really organize themselves because we believe that we're waiting to be saved by these political forces, which are not the working class, but, you know, some of whom, like the NDP, claim to represent the working class. So if you want to express your opposition in terms of a vote, go out and do it. You have some time. But I think the message that our interviewer, Louise Jones, is trying to pass on today is that working class people, more than anything else, need to organize themselves to bring their force to bear upon politicians and the broader forces in society that have influence over the elections, right? For example, throughout most of the elections, I noticed that a lot of the commentary around the elections was not on the substance of why people were going to the polls, right? What were the substantial issues? To the extent that the parties were talking to each other, they were mostly just saying, don't elect this guy, he's worse than me, he's worse than the next guy, elect us, you want to block the NDP from coming in, you want to block the Conservatives from coming in. And the other half of the discussion was taken up by just telling people to come out and vote, you know, imploring people that you have to vote. This is the very, you know, minimal basis of your citizenship that is the expression of your democratic rights, rather than inspiring people to vote with issues that actually are on their minds. Right? Many people, talking to people throughout the campaign, were saying, why are we not talking about rising energy prices, rising cost of living? Why are we not talking about another war in Libya? Right? Apparently, the government collapsed in part because of its unwillingness, in contempt of parliament, unwillingness to disclose the precise numbers that their new fighter jet program was going to cost. Well, those fighter jets were enthusiastically approved to be deployed by Jack Layton and the NDP. Right? They voted alongside everybody else in the House unanimously to support the invasion and bombing of yet another country. So, if you choose to go out and vote for the lesser of evils, whoever you think that is today, remember that vote, don't vote. What we really need to do is organize the people, organize working class people to defend our interests. Because from what we know, right, empirically, just looking at the surface of things, all the political parties in the era of neoliberalism in the last 30, 40 years, they have all attacked working class people. And this is precisely what people need to be organizing against. Just to conclude our show, I want to remind our listeners that we have the Mining and Justice Conference that's going to be happening at the University of Toronto this coming weekend. That's Mining and Justice Confronting Corporate Impunity, May 6th to 9th. It's going to be an opening event on May 6th at Beit Zeytoun. It's a meet and greet with affected community members and activists from all around the world. I know many from Latin America. Saturday, May 7th, a keynote speaker and a series of concurrent sessions will be happening at Sydney Smith Hall at the University of Toronto, to be followed by a dance party later in the evening. And on Sunday, May 8th, you'll have another keynote speaker and a series of concurrent sessions and as well as workshops. So check it out. Mining Injustice. Just Google it. Top of the list, whatever comes up, that's it. Mining Injustice. Also, this coming weekend, there's an event happening at OISE regarding the peace process playing out in the Philippines right now between the National Democratic Front of the Philippines and the Philippines government. And that event will be happening in OISE, but I actually don't have the room number on me, but I'm sure you can Google that as well. And to conclude our show, I'm going to go out with one more track. This is a track I just stumbled upon. It's from Das Racist. It's called Fake Patois. Man, I don't even know where to begin with this track. I don't even know what to make of this track and the video that goes with it. You know, it's as the name of the track suggests, Fake Patois. These rappers, Das Racist from Brooklyn, New York, are not Jamaican. It's one Latino and two South Asian dudes, as far as I can tell. But they're discussing an important point in rap, in hip-hop, and amongst musicians, fronting in their music like there's something that they ain't. You know, you got rappers and musicians fronting like they're from the hood, but maybe they're from Rosedale, right? Not to name anybody. According to this track, you know, fronting like you got patois, but it's really just fake patois. And of course, they're comically deploying fake patois as well. So I don't know what people are going to think about this track. I don't know if it's you're going to find it offensive, funny, brilliant. I didn't think it's offensive, so that's why I'm playing it. I thought it's an interesting commentary on the cultural appropriation of people's culture in order to legitimize money making schemes, getting rich. Major labels are doing this all the time, and their slaves, their artists are seriously appropriating genuine people's culture in order just to make themselves some money. So check out this track, Radio Basics. That's all we got for tonight. You can check us out. Remember, we are the radio wing of Basics Community News Service. You can check us out online at basicsnews.ca. And we regularly upload our shows here on Radio Basics to our website, basicsnews.ca. So you can check out a lot of our past shows. Much love, Toronto. And that's all I got to say. Respect. That's racist. Fake patois.
Charlie. Original. Original.
Original.
Black, 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 black. Turn me up in the headphone. Black. Turn the music up. Got the fake patois. Karis One did a fake patois. Miss Clue got a fake patois. Even Jay-Z did a fake patois. Bad Brains had a fake patois. My man Snow had a fake patois. Even Jim Carrey fuck with the patois. So you know we come through with the fake patois. Patois, got the fake patois. We come through with the fake patois. Patois, patois, patois. Fake, fake, patois. What you know about Sean Bridgemore? What you know about Sean Bridgemore? First Jamaican in a Kentucky Derby. First Jamaican in a Kentucky Derby. What you know about Sean Bridgemore? What you know about Sean Bridgemore? First Jamaican in a Kentucky Derby. First Jamaican in a Kentucky Derby.
Yeah, dog, one speak patois. Make one talk that fake patois. Everyone I listen to fake patois. Snow from Toronto, fake patois. Original rude boy. Original rude boy. Shabba ranks, catchy ranks. Mo missing, no tanks. Shabba ranks, cutty ranks. Yeah, Mo is Mo. Yeah, me right near the beach, right near my reach is the fire for the streets. Yeah, and now me can't read. Bald head teeth me book, and now me can't speak. Yeah, fake patois. This fake patois. Fake patois.
Alexander had a fake patois. Even Buzz around kinda sound patois. Maybe just a dread, make a look patois. When he speak, he just speak, but to me patois. No way he did do the patois with the leaders of the new, but the shit with brown brows. What you know about Sean Bridgemore? What you know about Sean Bridgemore? First Jamaican in the Kentucky Derby. First Jamaican in the Kentucky Derby. First Jamaican in the Kentucky Derby. Fake patois, fake patois.
Yeah. The boy a murderer. Here come the upstepper with fire on ya. Yeah, when I play games, this fake patois. When I take names, if the feds test me, me go on take aim. Crunch like Nestle, snipe from the planes. Snipe like Wesley, punch like Hawaiian. Snipe from the planes, yeah, we shoot while we're flying. Murder Shiro like Chaka, Demis and Pliers. More fire, more fire, more fire. This fake patois. This fake patois.
Don't fear. She not look at the big of me for me, shoot beside 10 fear. Me can't read cause I'm cheap, me book, but me still come with them fear. Me not look at the big of me for me, shoot beside 10 fear. Them fear. Them fear. She not look at the big of me for me, shoot beside 10 fear. Me got rich, cause I'm tipping both, but me come with them fear. She not look at the bigger me for me, show beside 10 fear. 10 fear.